Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm Giuseppe Porcaro.
I'm Alicia García Herrero.
And today we will land in Sri Lanka to both understand better the current crisis of the island as well its relation with China. This episode is part of Bruegel's focus on global China as seen from Europe, which includes our monthly newsletter Zhongguo Mundus, to which we invite you to subscribe. The link is in the show notes. Joining our conversation today is Asanga Abeyagonasekera. Is that correct, Asanga?
Thank you. Yes. Thank you for having me. Yes, that's correct.
Perfect. Who is an international security and geopolitics analyst and strategic advisor from Sri Lanka itself. He has led two government think tanks providing strategic advocacy with almost two decades of experience in the government sector in advisory position, is definitely an authority to let us understand better what is going on in the island. So thanks a lot for connecting with The Sound of Economics today. And if I'm correct, you're joining us from Washington, D.C.
Yes, that's correct.
Let's go to the topic. Sri Lanka is living one of its gravest crises at the moment. In May, the Prime Minister Mahinda Rajapaksa has resigned after long protests over the country's deepening economic crisis. For months, the country has been trapped in a brutal economic crisis. Sri Lanka is currently unable to pay for imports of essentials such as food, medicines and fuel. Tax cuts and abrupt ban on fertilizers imports, decimated crop yields and the collapse of tourism during the pandemic all helped to push the country into the worst economic crisis it has faced since gaining independence in 1948. The nation island owes nearly $7 billion this year, and has next to no foreign reserves left. After the preemptive announcement to suspend all foreign debt repayments until discussions for an IMF bailout are completed on May 18, Sri Lanka stepped into the dangerous path of a sovereign default. Asanga, can you explain to our listeners how did we get to this?
Yes, there are multiple factors. Out of this, I think in 2019, when Gotabaya Rajapaksa, the present president, came to power, it was a heavily autocratic regime which came to power with an inward ultra-nationalist posture, basically not taking in the sound advice that was given by IMF as well as international partners. It was the first time in Sri Lankan history we had a sibling regime where the prime minister was brother of the president and five others were also there, the family members. So it was a family rule, dynastic sort of rule, the government. And structural changes that was made initially to the constitution, bringing more power to the president from the legislature, as well as the 26 military appointments with a heavily militarized regime. Those are the factors to look at, basically an inward policy prescription that the government, for example, the fertilizer crisis, which I think we went into as a huge agricultural issue in Sri Lanka. So these multiple factors, as well as the borrowings, kept on borrowing in interest rates, which is 6% and more. So country could not sustain. And with the pandemic, as well as the tourism drop, the tax cut reform. So the fiscal policies that was adopted were not prudent. They were not practical. They were no objective. And these are the main factors, basically, that we got into this crisis. And today, unfortunately, four out of five are hungry. 22% of the population are hungry because they're only having one meal a day, according to the United Nations. We are now at a humanitarian crisis in Sri Lanka.
This is obviously incredibly worrying from what you are describing. And I don't know if Alicia wants to jump in already, but I have a first question, because of course you mentioned and we mentioned some of the causes of the crisis, but here at The Sound of Economics, we would like to understand a bit more about the role of foreign investments in this war story, how they evolved in the past few years. I mean, like having a bit of a backward view on what has been going on. And what's going on at the moment, the very moment, on this side?
Well, I would like to add, if I may, Giuseppe, to your question. I think it's important to note that Sri Lanka has been one of the landmarks of the Belt and Road Initiative, receiving a huge amounts of funding for project finance, including ports and other infrastructure projects. And I like to know from Asanga whether these projects were useful. And this is not only about China. I mean, it's, of course, the Sri Lankan government that needs to decide, you know, whether a project is useful or not. But the point is, how was that funding invested? And how does it come into the equation of the situation today?
I think China is a considerable factor. It is not the only factor, but it's a considerable factor of the crisis. The Chinese debt portfolio is about 10%, equal to Japan's. But we have borrowed at very high interest rates, 5.6%. Hambantota, for example, we borrowed for Hambantota port project 5 consecutive times. It's about $1.2 billion loan. But one particular transaction was on about 6.5% interest rates. So high interest rates, as well as the heavy borrowings per projects, which we could not sort of the business models, we could not gain any profit from it. Such as Matala Airport is a clear example. 203 million borrowings built near a natural sanctuary, wildlife sanctuary. It's not feasible. When I did a research on this particular airport, where the Auditor General has clearly mentioned it's not feasible. The EIA, the environmental impact assessments, how this was done is a question. So I think most of the BRI projects, Sri Lanka was one of the initial partners of the BRI from 2013. All of them, I mean, it moved from port projects to investment zones, to, airports, to water project, to multiple projects, power plants. But unfortunately, most of the BRI projects could not generate the revenue that is expected. Hambantota Port, for example, we were expecting thousands of ships, but only about 100 is there. So the expected revenue is not there. Then we have built, beautification projects such as, the tallest tower in Colombo. It has not generated any revenue. There's a revolving restaurant on the tower, but then these things have not, any sort of investment. So the Colombo Port City, which was, a reclaimed land in the seafront by the Chinese, is another good example. For 2 years, there's not been a single investor. When I interviewed the Chinese managing director of the Port City project, he clearly mentioned there will be European investors, there will be US investors coming in. I think the pandemic environment, the Easter Sunday bombing in Sri Lanka, so all that reduced a significant, the tourism portfolio also in Sri Lanka. So the BRI, unfortunately, has not done really well in Sri Lanka due to these factors. And there, I mean, I see another side to the BRI projects in Sri Lanka, which I call it a strategic trap, which is in three dimensions, I assess it. The first is the Chinese funding that has come to the political party level. I'm talking about IDCPC, which is the International Development for Chinese, you know, Communist Party, as well as the Rajapaksa political party, the SLPP. Then the human rights dimension, where Sri Lanka has been supported by China and Sri Lanka for the first time in its foreign policy, reciprocally supports Xinjiang, talking about Xinjiang. The third dimension is the surveillance and the military dimension. So these are three areas that are visible in Sri Lanka.
When you speak about these three areas, do you connect them as well with the current crisis, with the current political crisis?
Well, China did support the model, the heavily militarized model, which was introduced by the president in 2019, the 26th appointment. I mean, there was, I mean, out of the countries that supported the human rights concerns, you know, when Europe, EU, as well as the European Union start speaking about these concerns on the, you know, the reducing of the democratic essence in the country, as well as the human rights. But China was the only country that supported Sri Lanka in this area. So, it is a factor, the three dimensions I mentioned is a factor to the crisis, because the inward policy, such as the fertilizer ban, was the Rajapaksas were trying to introduce import subsidization, a more export-driven economy, an economy that is more sort of, you know, you grow your own vegetables. I mean, 2 days ago, there was an announcement saying Sri Lanka has now declared 4 days working for government servants, so not 5 days. So 1 day you take a break, and so you're given a day to grow vegetables. So these inward-looking factors, I mean, starting from initially, were the issues that they kept the sound advice away. IMF warned Sri Lanka multiple times, even the economic advisors. So that was the main issue.
Giuseppe, if I may, I mean, this is so interesting because, in a way, I was totally unaware of what one could even call, Sri Lanka's own dual circulation policy, if I may put it that way, because, you know, as you said, it's the idea of being less reliant, being able to have your own, in this case, of course, as simple as your own food, growing your food, so that you become less dependent on imports, which in a way, the current circumstances may make sense because unfortunately, Sri Lanka doesn't have enough reserves to pay for imports. But the whole idea is that it started before the crisis. And maybe, you know, as you're pointing out, it's part of the warnings from the IMF. But I want to go back to the IMF, if Giuseppe allows me. Because we were close. I may be wrong, but that's what my understanding, to a deal, to an IMF bailout. And something happened, and I wonder what happened. Is it related to debt restructuring, disagreements? So I really like to hear from you on that one.
Maybe on this, if I may add, because, of course, when we speak about IMF and bailouts, the first things that comes to our minds are the structural reforms packages, which were quite infamous back in the 80s and the 90s in the several parts of the world. Therefore, I mean, of course, the situation is completely changed. But what kind of choices they are? One is what kind of prospects, but what kind of choices there are on the table for Sri Lanka to go out of this crisis in a way that can be sustainable, not just from the balance sheet side, but also politically viable, and also something that is going to be feasible in order not to weigh too much on the population itself?
Some of the solutions that one of the first solution was talking to China. So when Wang Yi came to Sri Lanka, the president requested for debt restructuring, the Chinese debt, but that was rejected. That was not accepted by China. Without restructuring, so they mentioned that they could give another loan to settle their own loans. But what interest is a question still to the researchers. We don't know the interest. The 1.5 billion request was 1.5 billion credit line, as well as a 1.5 billion syndicate loan. I think it's important at this juncture to understand what are the interest rates of if we are further borrowing from China to settle the loans. Getting onto the IMF, to the same page of the IMF, is another concern for China, because the Chinese ambassador clearly mentioned that they don't want Sri Lanka to default, and that China would be there. But since Sri Lanka defaulted, it says that to treat all loans equally, this is what ambassador mentioned, that to the central bank, Chinese as well as the other loans. So here is a problem that the central bank of Sri Lanka is having, because to treat all the loans equally, because the Chinese loans are quite different to the other loans. So the IMF on the restructuring, how much China would accept, and what would be the conditionalities, or is the concern right now. Prime Minister has mentioned recently that he needs 5 billion immediately for the imports of the essential goods, such as medicine. We are out of medicine, the essential medicine. The food is a huge crisis. That's why I mentioned it is turned to a humanitarian crisis. So immediately Sri Lanka requires this assistance. India has come forward and amazingly given so much of assistance. In terms of oil shipments, the fuel, the essential basics. So that's going on right now. So the other countries also has, even the United States have mentioned that they would assist, and many others. So the fuel crisis is a serious issue, the food and the medicine. So immediately what it required is some funds to foreign reserves for the imports, I mean, to bring in the fuel as well as the essentials. So what Alicia mentioned, that you need to be on the same page with the IMF. That's important on the restructuring, and how much China would assist at this time is really, really important. The meeting between the US ambassador and the Chinese ambassador, which happened recently, is a good indication that both nations should come together to support a country like Sri Lanka and many other nations such as India. And because, I mean, people are hungry. The protests turned violent with burning of 40 houses of the Member of Parliament. Now, there is an indication that's coming from Colombo, which I have been sort of analyzing, that the next round of protests will be targeting the rich and the more affluent in the society. So Sri Lanka had two youth insurrections in 1988 and 1971. So it's not a country that didn't have sort of, you know, full-blown insurrections. It is a nation with such a volatile, I would say, a polity that it can turn into targeting with the sufferings of the people and the deaths, if the humanitarian crisis go out of control, it can move into that direction, unfortunately.
Alisa, do you want to add something on this before we move on? Because I have a more broader question zooming out from Sri Lanka to the region.
And we are using our time very efficiently, because we're getting really to the core of what our podcast is really about, is China in the world. And to just get a positive spin at the end of the day, because this has already happened. And of course, we need to solve this situation. I'm thinking, what kind of role could the G20, and especially given that it, you know, within the Indonesian presidency, I mean, any role, we got stuck with the DSSI, I mean, this debt restructuring agreement, and not restructuring, actually, simply a delay in payments, which was no longer agreeable during the Italian presidency. So we basically stopped it in December 2021 at the worst of all times, because that's when the Fed started to roar. Yeah, and I mean, I'm hiking rates and you guys are going to pay much more for your debt. And I think, given that we have that presidency, could, and this is the question, Sri Lanka be an example of, you know, what may happen to a lot of frontier markets, which are now confronted with humongously more expensive debt service because of Fed interest rates, but also, to be very frank, based on your conversation, because of China not agreeing fully, on the terms of a potential IMF deal. So I hope the question was clear. Sorry for the noise.
No, definitely. I mean, this can... on debt sustainability will be one of the key issues right now with the geopolitics in Europe as well as in Ukraine. Many commodity prices going up, the fuel prices. So there will be ripple effects of this to many nations. I mean, what happened to Sri Lanka, many nations could face. So right now, Sri Lanka, I mean, we are requesting assistance from everyone, international donors, the G20, everybody. So to, help us at this particular moment. And Sri Lanka need to reach out to all of them, I mean, who have been, President admitting that he was a good sign. He mentioned that he carried out several policy blunders that, during his, tenure, and he admitted on the fertilizer issues, on various inbred policies. So those are good signs, and the new prime minister welcoming, assistance, aid from many nations, reaching out. But here's the situation. I mean, I see a few factors also that is not so attractive. Weeks ago, there was an appointment with political favoritism. Again, a casino owner, a boss, was appointed to the member of parliament. Protesters were very angry over this. It's a very fragile situation. So you're satisfied the protest is still going on. So protest, they're saying we need a new culture. They're blaming the political culture for this. So, which I agree, of course, with the protesters, there is a component there on, working on, basically intervening on the judiciary, making constitutional amendments whenever they want. So, and also on high level of corruption. So, the voices of the protesters are true. I mean, those concerns need to be addressed. So, I think the priority needs to be set more than micro level adjustments, such as, giving one day off, to grow vegetables or to minimize the cost for the government's servants. I think more macro level is what is required on tax adjustments, as well as on the debt restructuring. So that is what is immediately required. And India, for sure, the neighboring country, can assist so much in this regard. I mean, in the past, also India has assisted. So there are several areas that we could focus on. I mean, it's a country that depends heavily on tourism, unfortunately. So the tourism industry has completely dried up. And so what we need is like some sort of relief from some of those sectors to stabilize the country immediately. And so China, US, and many other countries, European, EU, especially on the Sri Lankan exports. So it can help. EU has helped Sri Lanka, so much in terms of crisis. And this is a time that Sri Lanka requires assistance. But Sri Lanka also needs to take more objective measures, as well as, you know, moving towards a more democratic, showing the human rights areas and improvements in many other areas. So it requires all that. The political instability is still there because we have a prime minister appointed. He has only one seat. One seat in the parliament. The first time in the Sri Lankan history, again, we have a prime minister with one seat, supported by the Rajapaksa regime's parliamentarians. So here is a liberal prime minister, needs to work with the inward policy. So it's sort of a duality, I see. While he's projecting more liberal values, you have the people who support him talking about, you know, the ultra-nationalists. So this is where the problem is. It's a interim government, I see. It's not a because you cannot have a prime minister with one seat and supported by the other side. So interim government until elections. So the 21st Amendment is another thing, which is a structural adjustment promised by the prime minister to reverse the power which the president got from the 20th Amendment, which is from the legislator to the president. So he's going to reverse it back. And here's the thing, the civil society is not so happy of the document. So I heard from hear from Dr. Jehan Pereira, who's a civil society activist and academic. He mentioned that, you know, it cannot be, I mean, what is promised is not seen in the document. So these are a lot of things. I mean, I think more than structural adjustments in the political area, what is required is immediate relief on the economic side. And because if you don't settle the economics, you will get into a security situation. This is my worry.
We are going to go towards the end of this episode quite soon. But Asanga, from what you're saying, you are quite clear about the humanitarian crisis that there is at the moment and the immediate action that needs to be taken on this side. Then, of course, there is the economic part that needs to be solved a bit as a prerequisite in order to move forward. But what you are ringing the alarm bell is that the political situation stays hyper mega fragile at the moment. And for something that started with a political crisis in the first place, this might be a little bit of a catch, like how can you solve the economic issues if on the political side there is such a huge volatility and fragility? You mentioned about tourism, which could have been an engine of recovery at that stage when, you know, at least here in Europe and other regions are starting to again travel intercontinentally and going towards holiday periods and stuff like this. But obviously in such a political environment, that's not going to be a viable option for that industry to recover at that stage. So it's a little bit of from what I understand, there is a quite intricate situation. And it doesn't, I mean, at least I didn't get from your analysis some sort of immediate way out of the political impasse. This might take a little bit of time, right? Will elections per se going to be sorting out such intricacy, or do we need to look more on the medium to longer term for this political crisis to be solved? And how, you know, what are the more medium-term kind of prospects? Also, because it would be good to look a little bit more ahead, two steps ahead, if it's possible. If it's possible for you to project us on this longer period, longer time span period, before we wrap up the conversation.
No, I think, yes, I mean, your observation is also correct. The immediate elections is what the protesters are asking, because one of the main themes of the protesters is called Go Home Gota. Gota means the president, Gotabaya. Now, the family has gone out of all the positions, but except for the president. So the protesters are saying, okay, our theme was the president to go. Now, the prime minister he's been prime minister for 5 times. This is the 6th time that he's prime minister, well-experienced prime minister. So he put some moral sort of a dimension to it, saying that if you don't support, right now you'll be in a serious crisis. So it's more of a moral dilemma, like, you know, you need to support this situation right now, or you get into a humanitarian or, you know, a serious crisis, which is true. You need the political stability right now. So requested from all parties to join, but the opposition leader has taken a very strong position, saying that he will not join the Rajapaksas. So because Rajapaksas are authoritarian, and he's a democratic leader, and he will not join an authoritarian leader. So he is a dilemma that you have. And then the elections, they're asking for it, but then you have the economic crisis to stabilize. My assessment is that all parties need to come together and support this interim regime. This is an interim regime, because a prime minister with one seat, you cannot, and he's not elected by the people. It was a swap done at the parliament. So an interim regime with all parties supporting for economic stability, at least for a few months, because the elections are due in about a year for the parliamentary elections. But parliamentary elections you can keep immediately if the majority is reached from the opposition, then they can dissolve the parliament and go for elections anytime. But the Rajapaksas, the member of parliament are supporting the prime minister. So I think it is required, but all parties to stabilize the economy is what is required, because many people are hungry. The people will die if it goes on like this. UN has given a clear warning, which I believe is absolutely correct. And so I think all parties, all members of the civil society needs to come to and support in this situation, so the ambassadors can easily work to stabilize the situation is what is very important, because what you hear in the news are very disturbing right now. Children would die from without medicine in the village level, at the village level. So these things are trigger factors for another sort of a full-blown up, sort of like the protests turning to violence. So I think it needs a sort of a delicate balance here, satisfying the protesters as well as you. I mean, there have been crackdowns of the protest also. So this has been seen as it's not a democratic process to do that. And I think all these factors need to sort of come into play, and an immediate balance is sort of required, and all parties need to come together.
And I would like to thank you, and of course we could speak for much longer about that, but unfortunately that's all the time we have for today's episode. But we are going to keep closely monitoring the situation in Sri Lanka, and as you've seen, more for the broader context of our Zongo Mundus series, this is an extremely interesting case studies within the frame of the global outreach of China, and a companion to another podcast episode that we recently recorded, which was about the Belt and Road Initiative. So if you want to have some more background information about the Belt and Road Initiative, I suggest you to listen to the other episode as well, which is linked in the show notes. I would like like to thank you, Asanga, for your time and analysis. And this brings us to the end of this episode. And I would also like to remind everyone that you can read in open access all the analysis by our scholars on our website, www.bruegel.org. Asanga, Alicia, once again, thanks a lot for joining, and thanks to our listeners for following us.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Alicia. Thank you.
Until next time, bye-bye.